Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
There's a new report out on the BP oil spill today. The moral of the story is pretty easy. Follow the money. Why this is actually a good time to be General Motors. And Freakonomics Radio is back. The things you learn going through somebody's trash. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, committed to customer choice and powering America's clean energy future through investments in natural gas, nuclear, wind, solar, and efficiency technologies. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, today, the 11th of January. Great to have you with us. 9 months, and we still don't know exactly how many millions of barrels of oil later. The White House Commission on the BP spill in the Gulf of Mexico issued its report today. The gist of it, you can probably guess. We need new rules for how to drill way out where the water is so deep. We need to raise oil company liability limits, and we need to figure out new safety standards. In fact, the panel recommends no new permits for drilling up in the Arctic until safety technology matches drilling ability. The drilling industry is not so happy about that, as you might imagine, but companies that develop new oil technologies, they think it's just fine. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Eve Troe reports.
BP's Macondo well was the cutting edge of engineering at the bottom of the sea. But when the well blew out, the technology to address it was decades old. Terrence O'Hanlon studies industrial risk at Reliability Web. He says oil companies knew about that gap, but didn't invest in closing it.
It would be like going into an operation and your surgeon understanding all the ways that the surgery could go south, so to speak, yet not having the capability to respond to it.
He says most of the prevention and response technology is on the market, but a government cap on corporate liability removes the incentive to pay for it.
Let's see, we could spend, $200 million on an underwater vehicle that might be able to respond to this, or we could pay the $75 million fine.
The commission recommends lifting the limit on that fine. O'Hanlon says that would get companies to pay to perfect safety technology. But they also need to fund scientific research, says Mike Levine. He works in Alaska with the nonprofit Oceana. Levine says companies don't yet know how to respond to disasters there. For example, whether one kind of oil dispersant works better under ice than another.
So if there was a way to fund the necessary science and research, it might go a long way to furthering decisions about whether we can undertake these activities sustainably.
But of course, someone would have to underwrite that new research. Congress will have to decide whether it's worth government investment or a tax on the oil industry to do so. I'm Eve Troe for Marketplace.
11 people were killed when the Deepwater Horizon blew up and sank last April. That accident was just the latest in a string of problems that BP's had with safety and following the rules. Bloomberg reporter Allison Fitzgerald has just finished a new book on BP and its troubled history. It's called Into the Deep. Allison, welcome to the broadcast.
Thanks for having me, Kyle.
Until the Deepwater Horizon blew up, BP had been doing pretty well in the Gulf. I mean, that's the scenario that you lay out for us in this book.
Oh, sure. BP had great success in the Gulf. They were by far the most successful company at finding new oil in the deepest water. They, in the last 8 years or so, replaced at a rate of 130% all the oil that they produce.
130%. So they were finding more than they were selling.
Right. Exactly.
You go back to the days of John Brown, the former CEO of BP, who was replaced by Tony Hayward. And I want to spend some mm-hmm. time with him because he is the guy really who took BP, consolidated it, grew it, and in a way drove it to the point where BP was the night the Deepwater Horizon exploded.
Exactly. Brown is quite a character himself. He was a very, very ambitious CEO, but he, you know, for most of his life was a closeted gay mm-hmm. man who had a very sort of highbrow taste, preferring opera compared to his Texas colleagues, who was quite different, but incredibly successful in this industry. He took BP from being sort of a middling oil company to, depending on the year, the third or fourth biggest oil company in the world and the biggest producer in the United States.
John Brown aside, though, how was BP different than Chevron or ExxonMobil?
It was a company of adventurers in many ways. Its history started that way, and it continued where their biggest and most prestigious division was the oil exploration division, the geologists, the guys who went out and found the oil. They weren't as strong nor as interested in getting that oil to the market, doing the pipelining, refining. And that's where, you know, some of their problems came from. Making sure all the plumbing, you know, was functioning properly wasn't the thing that was valued at BP. And therefore, the safety of those parts of the company was often overlooked to a degree.
How much of what happened in the Gulf of Mexico last spring and summer was the result of this culture at BP that you've been talking about? And how much was the lack of interested oversight on the part of the government?
It's a combination. One of the things that you saw was BP made a whole series of blunders, decisions, and they were identified today by the Oil Spill Commission. However, the government had never set strong standards on how to shut in the well, nor how to read the tests that determine whether the well is safe, nor what to do if you have a blowout like this.
My guess would be that oil industry defenders will say, and you know, they've said this in almost as many words, this is basically rocket science going the other way, right? I mean, it's like the moonshot.
Oh, yeah.
We are doing things that we just can't quite figure out. And if we want oil in this economy, it's dirty, messy, and dangerous.
Yes. And you know what? They would be right. But what went wrong here wasn't a massive engineering disaster. It was little decisions, day-to-day decisions that were made at a lower level without doing a thorough risk assessment, thinking it through, or knowing this is against the rules, so I better not do it or I might get fired.
Allison Fitzgerald is an investigative reporter at Bloomberg News. She is the co-author with Stanley Reed of a new book about BP called In Too Deep, BP and the Drilling Race That Took It Down. Allison, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much, Kai.
On Wall Street today, American investors in BP didn't look twice at that report. BP picked up 1.75%. The major indices did just fine as well. Not as well as BP, but just fine. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's time now for a little Freakonomics Radio. It's that moment every couple of weeks where we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It is about the hidden side of everything. Dubner, always good to have you back.
There is no place I'd rather be.
All right, I don't believe that. But anyway, so I was in New York a while ago, a couple of months ago, came by your apartment, and you had me do this thing that was actually rather disgusting. Let's roll some tape here.
All right, I have brought my my latex gloves. So, you know, this won't hurt a bit. Let's go have a look at your trash. We have flowers.
Those were my wife's.
Okay, I'm sorry. Seriously, on the top of the recycling thing is a little Dewar's scotch, white label.
Now, aren't you glad I at least recycle? But Kai, don't you think we should explain to the people why you were actually going through my trash?
We should. We had some time to kill on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. No. You have this thing about trash and the economics thereof, right?
Guilty as charged.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. Trash is a gorgeous illustration of what you call the free rider problem. A lot of us just take our trash for granted. We stick it out on the curb. Voila, it disappears.
Except we pay for it, right? It's either in our property taxes or it's in our water bills. I mean, it's not like it's free-free.
Right. It's not free-free, but the fee is hidden. And moreover, the fee is a flat fee, which means I get to throw away as much trash as I want. So why bother to produce less? If my electricity bill were a flat fee every month, I would never turn off a single light in my house.
Right.
Listen to Lisa Skumats. She's an economist at a consulting firm that helps cities deal with their trash.
Makes me think about an all-you-can-eat buffet, as in all-you-can-throw-out trash, with no incentives for people to think about the cost of what they're doing.
Now, for 25 years, Skoumatz has been working with a model called pay-as-you-throw, which forces people to put their money where their trash is.
Yeah, they have it actually here in parts of L.A. It's the more you put on the curb, basically, the more you pay.
So you're kind of at the center of the boom, and it has been a big boom. A few years ago, 20 years ago, you go back, fewer than 200 places in the U.S. had pay-as-you-throw, and now we're up to about 7,000, or about a quarter of the country. So a trash consultant like Lisa Skoumatz, she loves it. Now that people are paying for what they toss, their behavior changes. And here's the best part. If you're a government, pay-as-you-throw makes it easy for you to start billing directly people for trash pickup. So, bingo, new revenue stream. Sounds pretty win-win, right?
Yeah, if you're in, you know, the mood of giving the government your money. But okay, go ahead.
Exactly. Some people, as you could intuit, are a little bit less than thrilled by it.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure there are effigies of me hanging from numerous places in people's houses.
That's Mark Green, who's the town manager of Sanford, Maine. Sanford introduced pay-as-you-throw last July. People had to pay $2 for every big purple pay-as-you-throw bag of trash. It worked great. Trash volume was cut in half. But some people there in Sanford, like Len Mustachio, they thought the idea stank.
Anything that's a fee, you might as well be a tax. It's one and the same. You don't have a choice. Although they'll tell you, well, you do have a choice. You can throw out less garbage. Well, what am I supposed to do, eat it?
So nice. In November, after just 4 months, the voters in Sanford repealed pay-as-you-throw.
Yeah, so Dubner, get me to the hidden side of this. I mean, incentives matter, right? So if you tax, essentially, trash, what happens?
Well, you got to understand, incentives matter, and the people who design them think they know how people are going to respond to them. But the fact is, they don't. You introduce an incentive, and people respond to it in the way that benefits them. So with the trash tax, yes, a lot of people might pay dutifully. Some towns like Sanford, Maine might repeal their tax. And other places, they'll do things like in Ireland, there was a spike in emergency room visits for burn victims because a lot of people started burning trash in their backyard to avoid the new tax. This is kind of where economics and psychology hook up. If you're accustomed to getting something for free and then you're asked to pay for it, even if it's just a couple of bucks, you might get really unhappy. Like if all of a sudden I started charging you, Kai, a dollar every time you said the word Freakonomics on the radio.
Okay, so you know what? You actually wouldn't be on the radio very much. That's actually what would happen. But we will bring you back again in a couple of weeks. That's Stephen Dubner, Freakonomics Radio. Can you find
$1 right there. $1 right there.
Freakonomicsradio.com is his website. $2. See you in a couple of weeks.
My pleasure, Kai. Thanks.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Microsoft, providing comprehensive business solutions for the cloud. You can learn more at Microsoft.com/cloud.
Coming up, forget Times Square. There is way more to Manhattan.
Harlem is a dynamic neighborhood, and certainly it's up and coming, and it made sense to go into an emerging neighborhood.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials held on today to gain 34 points, 0.3%, closed at 11,671 points. The NASDAQ added 0.9%, finished at 2716. The S&P 500 ticked up 4 points. That's more than 0.3%, ended things at 1274. Among the blue chips, Chevron fueled up 1.5% today on higher oil prices. Hewlett-Packard gained 1.25%. Telecom weighed again on the big board. The looming battle over iPhone customers beat down AT&T and Verizon. Both each gave back about 1.5% on this Tuesday. Advanced Micro Devices sank 9% today after the computer chip maker said it is seeking a new CEO to boost growth. Homebuilder Lennar nailed up 7% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.34%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact Event Marketing, working to help small businesses and nonprofits make their events easier with event registration and marketing tools. ConstantContact.com. By CSX, whose trains move a ton of freight nearly 500 miles on 1 gallon of fuel to help reduce fuel consumption. CSX, how tomorrow moves. And by LendingTree, providing up to 4 loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 1-800-555-8733. Thank you.
Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen. Marketplace Datebook. Here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The Federal Reserve issues its Beige Book summary of commentary on current economic conditions. The Treasury Department releases the federal budget for December. And events in Port-au-Prince mark the one-year anniversary of the earthquake that devastated Haiti. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Strange though it may be for you to hear this, given the bankruptcy and the bailout, this is not actually a bad time to be General Motors. Sales are up. Drivers are excited about the cars that GM makes. The Chevy Volt was just named Car of the Year at the Detroit Auto Show. So General Motors has everything an auto company could want, except an in-house finance business. According to the Wall Street Journal today, General Motors is looking to change that. It wants to buy back Ally Bank, the company formerly known as GMAC. Marketplace's Elisa Roth reports.
The car business is really cash intensive. Dealers have to buy vehicles from the manufacturers, and drivers need access to money to buy from the dealers.
People just don't pay cash for automobiles. They need financing to fund something of that size.
Sean McElinden is chief economist at the Center for Automotive Research. He says dealers need to borrow, too. So-called captive finance arms, like Ford Motor Credit or Toyota Financial, lend to dealers and car buyers. They're wholly owned subsidiaries of the car makers. Andy Koblenz is with the National Automobile Dealers Association. He says that means they offer a competitive edge.
It's very valuable for the dealers to have a captive finance arm associated with their manufacturer. It's not the end of the world if they don't, but there's definite benefits to it.
GM sold its captive finance company, which used to be called GMAC, in 2006 when it needed money. McElinden, the economist, says not having in-house financing puts GM at a disadvantage because it could be making money off the loans or selling more cars by offering better rates to buyers.
It's like letting Ford make an extra $1 billion a year or $1.5 billion on their finance arm, and you don't have that profit. I mean, eventually, that's going to hurt you.
GM may have to look elsewhere, though. 6 months ago, Ally turned down the carmaker's offer to buy part of its business. Ally wouldn't comment today. GM didn't return calls before deadline. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
You should know that Ally Bank is an underwriter of this broadcast. So if you saw the BCS National Championship game last night, you couldn't have missed all the product placement in the middle of that show. The game was played at the University of Phoenix Stadium, for Pete's sake, one of the biggest for-profit colleges in the country. For years, schools like the University of Phoenix have been tremendously profitable, but not so these days. New regulations that are cracking down on recruiting practices and high student loan burdens, not to mention a ton of bad publicity, are keeping students away by the thousands, as Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports.
The University of Phoenix says new student enrollment was down more than 40% this fall. This quarter isn't expected to get any better. Strayer University, another for-profit, says its new student enrollment is down 20%. Part of the falloff may have to do with changes in the way recruiters are paid.
Some of those enrollment counselors, as you may expect, have become less productive.
Less productive, says analyst Amy Yunker, because they no longer get commission. They earn a flat salary, no matter how many students they bring in. The University of Phoenix has also added a 3-week mandatory orientation program so it can weed out students who aren't prepared for university-level courses. Brendan Dobell is with investment firm William Blair.
I think the students in a large majority of online programs go into it with an incomplete view of how tough it is.
And many of them end up saddled with debt. New regulations may mean for-profit programs would lose access to federal student aid if too many of their graduates don't earn enough to pay off their loans. Dobell says these rules may force a shakeout among for-profit schools.
I think what you're going to end up seeing is a lot of small schools are going to go out of business.
He says the larger schools are making the kinds of changes that will allow them to keep earning a profit. Okay, maybe a more modest one. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
All right, riddle me this. Does Donald Trump really belong on the list of the super rich? And why are the names of some multi-billionaires just missing from the popular rankings we get every year from Forbes magazine? Well, if questions like that lurk in the back of your mind, we may soon be getting a second opinion when it comes to who's ultra-wealthy and who's not. Bloomberg News has just hired away the longtime editor of the Forbes 400, and Bloomberg is said to be planning its own rankings as soon as next year. But just for consistency's sake here, riddle me this. Is this really the time to be focusing on the rich? Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
Even one of the richest men in the world, Warren Buffett, has been sensitive to his high-flying status given the tough times facing the average wage earner.
He's been on a treadmill while the super rich have been on a spaceship.
So why would Bloomberg News think now's the time to emphasize its coverage of the rich?
You would think that during the economic downtimes, there'd be less of a concern about the wealthy or, in fact, negative feelings, anger or frustration toward the wealthy.
And you'd be wrong, says University of San Francisco psychologist Jim Taylor. He says from Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg to the fictional Carringtons of Dynasty, we've always been fascinated by the rich, maybe even more so now.
Escapism, fantasy, wishful thinking does, however unrealistically, provide some relief and comfort for people during these very difficult times.
Taylor says Americans have always been interested in who's made it and how they got there, which is why the Wall Street Journal, too, has a writer focused on the wealthy, Robert Frank.
Bill Gates is worth more than some small countries, and Mark Zuckerberg is 26 years old and already worth about, you know, whether it's $6 billion or $8 billion or $12 billion, more than probably anyone his age has ever been worth. That tells the story of our times in a way that we've never seen in history.
Frank expects Bloomberg to put special emphasis on global rankings, where he says emerging wealth holds its own fascination. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
For the first time in 40 years, one of New York City's most famous neighborhoods has a major new hotel to boast about. Harlem hasn't had a brand name place to stay since the 1960s. Starwood Hotels has broken that dry spell with a new boutique chain. The Aloft Hotel in Harlem opened just after New Year's. But the controversy over what the new development is doing to the area has been brewing for a while now. Marketplace's Janet Babin reports.
I'm waiting for a tour of the Aloft Hotel in what I assume is the lobby. But the hip, tech-savvy travelers the hotel's trying to attract equate lobbies with waiting. Bad. Here's Aloft sales director, Alex Truglio.
So instead of a lobby, we have the remix area. And that is comprised of the Aloha desk, our check-in area. The
Aloha is the standard staff greeting.
Aloha, Adrian. Just watch your step here. Mm-hmm.
Truglio shows me a typical room, spacious by Manhattan standards, 9-foot ceilings, and a clear view of Harlem's iconic Apollo Theater.
Showtime at the Apollo!
The last hotel in Harlem, the Teresa, catered to Apollo performers who were shut out of other Manhattan hotels. The Teresa closed in 1967. Over the next two decades, drugs and crime moved into the neighborhood, and blacks who could afford to moved out. Columbia University professor Lance Freeman says it took Harlem another decade to begin its recovery.
Probably starting in the late 1990s, where you really start to see gentrification happening, people buying and refurbishing brownstones, opening up restaurants or boutiques.
Now, fueled in part by rising rents in the rest of Manhattan, the latest Harlem Renaissance is underway. Starwood Hotel's VP Brian McGinnis says Harlem can attract tourists who'd normally stay in Midtown.
Harlem is a dynamic neighborhood, and certainly it's up and coming, and it made sense to go into an emerging neighborhood, you know, introducing the new Harlem and being part of rewriting the next chapter of history for that area.
But some Harlem residents say they're the ones who should rewrite that chapter. Not long before the Aloft opened, a group called the Harlem Tenants Council led a small protest against gentrification. That is, the displacement of locals by wealthy buyers who snatch up Harlem property. Organizer Nellie Hester Bailey says the Aloft Hotel is an example of predatory development.
Landlords and developers have targeted Harlem to develop luxury housing far beyond the means of Harlem residents.
Rooms at the Aloft average about $240 a night. The building's condos sell for $340,000 to more than $1 million. A few blocks over from the Aloft, celebrity chef Marcus Samuelson recently opened a new restaurant, the Red Rooster.
You have the mushrooms there? All right.
On a busy Monday night, Samuelson prepped his staff for VIPs.
So like Charlie Rose is coming in today. So what? It's not just hi, welcome, it's like welcome back, Mr. Rose, right?
Yes.
Good.
Samuelson, who is of Ethiopian and Swedish descent, says gentrification doesn't have to be about exclusion. He hopes old and new Harlem mingle at the Red Rooster.
You can sit in the bar, have a beer, and have cornbread, and we're going to treat you just as good as the person that is super VIP and pays $300.
At a time when African Americans face higher jobless rates than the national average, the Aloft Hotel and the Red Rooster have hired locals. More than half of the restaurant's employees live in Harlem. Gentrification's effect on a neighborhood is hard to measure, and plenty of Harlem residents welcome the new businesses. Clemmy Rice has been here for 8 years. He passes the Red Rooster on his way home from work.
You know, you're going to have some negative people that's going to feel that, you know, they disagree with it, but then you're going to have a lot of people that's in the area that think there's a great thing, and I'm one of them that feel there's a great thing.
Dinner guests have begun to gather at the restaurant, but tonight the crowd is even thicker at a tiny storefront just a few doors down, a reminder of a less glamorous Harlem. The store's red neon sign blares, checks cashed. In New York, I'm Janet Babin for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, helping doctors, lawyers, and small business owners monitor, protect, and improve their online reputations. ReputationDefender.com. And by Putnam Investments, committed to helping families across America pursue their college savings goals on the web at putnam.com/529. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, it looks like Goldman Sachs has finally had enough of its reputation as a great vampire squid wrapped around the face of humanity. That characterization, sadly, isn't mine. It's the tagline from an article in Rolling Stone last year about the Darth Vader of investment banks. And frankly, now that I think of it, maybe that's the more apt metaphor. Goldman Sachs wants you to know it's really a good guy deep inside. The company released a big report today promising transparency. It's going to tell investors more about how it makes the billions of dollars in profit that it does make. It's going to figure out how sophisticated, Goldman's word, its clients are before it offers investment opportunities. And to quote the report once again, it's reputational risk management, which is my favorite business buzzword of the day by far. And on that note, that's Marketplace from American Public Media on this Tuesday. Today, the Dow gained 34 points, about 0.3%. The NASDAQ up 9 points, 0.3%. The S&P 500 ticked up 4 points. More than 0.3%. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our morning report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Beat, and that's where you ought to tune in the morning for the latest in business and economic news. Coming up next time back on this show, why our digital future may still include the old-fashioned credit card.
It would cost hundreds of billions of dollars to change the magnetic stripe infrastructure in the United States and re-educate the merchants that use it.
I'm Kai Ruzdahl. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.